joining Glenn with us today in the show. We have Daniel Norman from Prisma. How are you doing today, sir?
Very well. Nice to be here.
So what did you do to get this role with Prisma?
Well, I've been working as a software engineer for about 10 years, and in the last couple of years, I became really interested in education and just writing in general. And then I was on a short break in between projects, and I was looking around, and I, you know, I'd been using a little bit of Prisma One, and I saw that they had an opening for the developer advocate role. So one thing led to another, and there I was. It seemed like a really good fit, and yeah, and I've been with Prisma for about half a year now.
So is Prisma essentially a code generation tool?
That's one aspect of it, sure. But I think it's sort of, to sum it up succinctly, I would say that Prisma is a type-safe database access library.
Okay. Right. And what are the technologies that power this this library?
So the idea is that you as a developer, you want to access your database, and assuming that you're using Node.js with JavaScript or TypeScript, you would use either query builders or an ORM, depending on which database you're using. And so what Prisma does is it generates a client that is in TypeScript that is based on your database schema. Mm-hmm. And then in order to do that, it uses Rust and TypeScript under the hood. So in your source code, you essentially, you import a TypeScript library. If you're using JavaScript, you can also import it. And under the hood, it will actually start this process that is written in Rust, which is called the query engine. And that will handle a lot of the sort of heavy lifting with regards to the database. Mm-hmm.
So what databases does it support deploying to?
So the idea with Prisma is for it to be database agnostic and to support multiple databases. And right now we support Postgres, MySQL, MariaDB, which I believe is also Wire compatible with MySQL, and SQLite, if I hadn't mentioned that.
Wire compatible, what does that mean?
So I believe that MariaDB was actually a fork of MySQL. And then the nature of these forks is that they often change some of the implementation details of the database. But by it being wire compatible, it means that it's just using the same sort of communication protocol. So that if you have access libraries that were written for MySQL, you can also use them with MariaDB. And there's obviously other examples of this. You know, there's many Postgres users out there. And I think a couple of years ago, a database called CockroachDB came up. And the idea with Cockroach is for it to be built for distributed environments. And CockroachDB actually has a completely different sort of engine under the hood compared to Postgres, but it is wire compatible with Postgres, meaning that a lot of the same drivers that you would use for Postgres would also work with CockroachDB.
I see. So each adapter or connectors for the databases, how much maintenance does it need to, how often do you have to update the connectors so that it works with all the latest versions of the various databases, and how do you decide how much backward compatibility to keep?
That's a good question. So usually databases, the way that they're developed is to try to maintain as much backwards compatibility. So the introduction of new features in databases typically doesn't involve breaking changes. So it's very rare that a new feature would break an existing connection to a database. But new features are obviously have to be accessed somehow. So usually that's the kind of thing where upgrading the adapter or the driver, depending on your use case, would allow you to use some of the new features. But if you're using an older version, generally it shouldn't break any of the existing functionality, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah. So in a sense, what I'm seeing is that Prisma is a tool for generating SQL for relational databases.
Yes, that's a correct
It doesn't support anything like NoSQL or graph database kind of stuff.
At the time, it doesn't. There is some work being done on the Mongo driver, but right now the sort of focus is getting all of the relational databases like Postgres, MySQL, and actually supporting a lot of the different functionality that each of them offers.
Because that seems like a hard enough task as it is. I mean, it's hard enough just learning one database well. I mean, I spent 1 year doing MySQL, 4 years doing SQL Server, Microsoft, and I still only scratched the surface on all the stuff it can do.
Absolutely. And in fact, that is probably one of the biggest motivations behind Prisma. So the idea is to make it, so when you're working with a database, really the thing that you care about is your data, how you represent that data, and trying to make that accessible to developers who are building applications without them having to really know all of the details under the hood of the database is, I think, an achievable goal, and a goal that Prisma already achieves to some degree.
Yeah, I remember, like, even the differences between SQL Server and MySQL was, like, there was so much difference, like, the way that you wrote triggers and the way that, well, everything when it came to my SQL Server, which is confusing MS SQL, is, like, use the GUI for everything, whereas all the stuff that I was doing for MySQL, I was using just the command line, and then there was other tools that came along, like GUIs for MySQL, but they weren't as well integrated as SQL Server. But eventually you just get tired of using the GUIs in these sort of tools, and then I moved on to Entity Framework, and that was just so confusing for me. Like, it was just so, you had to install Visual Studio, and then you had just so much terminology to learn and things like that. Eventually I did manage to learn how to use it, but then I moved off from using Microsoft products for a lot of stuff when I went into front-end development, like, full-time. But I'm building a little social network with Firebase, but I'm got the back in my head that this stuff could be quite expensive pretty soon if I get a modest amount of users. So the next app that I build, I want to try and probably use Prisma for the back end, you know.
Right, yeah. I guess one of the biggest concerns with something like Firebase would be the lock-in that you have to the Firebase ecosystem. And that is not even mentioning perhaps some of the constraints that Firebase has.
Well, I mean, the code that I'm writing for Mentor CV, the front end could be swapped out pretty easily with the back end. All the back end stuff is contained just within I better be careful, I don't show any private keys here. Because I've just been working on some private key stuff. Like, Firebase backend stuff is pretty much swap in place. As long as I return the correct data back to the client, it won't break things. So, this unfollow user basically returns a promise, and then I've got things like return a boolean if add connection works. So this is the only logic that's specific to Firebase here. Is basically, I'm getting the auth, and this is the storing the data, which is very concise for what it does, you know. But the way I'm structuring this app, it's all NoSQL based. So, like, the rationale for storing things is a bit non-relational, like, you know. So basically, I'm having to store duplicate data around just so I can query it more effectively.
This is with Firebase essentially, yeah, because you don't use the idea of, like, relations. So You have a lot of data that sort of duplicates because you have it nested within a document.
Yeah, there's basically a lot of the stuff that Firebase is nice for is it gives you these security rules so that you don't have to write back-end logic for it. But the rules are, like, optimized for large-scale distributed database like Firebase is. So, like, they have to be very, very specific. And so, like, if you want to have some validation on some data, sometimes you have to duplicate the data and store it in another path. So then you have, you can create this query in the rule. It's just a bit...
Can you share maybe a little bit more about the sort of the data schema, the schema of like how data is with Firebase? And I'm just curious see.
I can't remember what tab I was using.
Too many tabs syndrome.
Right. So basically I'm in development, so I'm basically wiping the data quite a lot. So I think I've got data in here right now. So my computer's kind of slow because my webcam's on. I'm going to turn my webcam off so that I get back more speed. This is one of those things with Mac. This is the latest MacBook Pro. You'd think that they would eventually have
the ability to
have a fast computer without the webcam slowing me down. But people know what I look like anyway, so you're the new fresh face here on the podcast, right?
Right.
Hopefully I've not got any public emails here and stuff like that. But, so basically, this is Mentor CV, right? And we have users, and then we have this UID, which is what is stored in authentication for every user. And this is, so you have authentication, which handles user sign up, login, change password, that stuff. And then basically this is totally customizable. This is, you can decide the schema. And when you write to the data, it will write immediately to the schema as long as it has validation rules for it. So at the moment, I have permissions to write within user's path, and then I have some rules around what the username can be. And this username here, I can only write to username if the username is not already existing in username lookup. Originally, I didn't have this username lookup. I wanted to query this as a database rule to say, can I enter? So I don't want to have users to create somebody else's username. So unfortunately with Firebase, what you had to do is I had to duplicate this data so then I could write it in like that. And when I do the search functionality, you can't search via case agnosticism. So when the user creates a username, basically I have to duplicate that as well and make it lowercase so I can search for it properly.
I see. Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing that would be resolved by a unique constraint, right?
So you can see it's kind of complicated here. So like in the user's path, username under the user ID, we have to make sure that it doesn't already exist within this other thing here. And then...
I see. So these are essentially, these aren't authorization rules. These are validation rules for that.
Yeah, but this is actually really powerful because you don't have to write back-end logic to validate user queries from the client. You know what, this can only store that, you know, and this does take a while to get my head around this. This is me took me weeks to get even to this point. A lot of Stack Overflow as well. So.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a good experience, a good learning experience, you know, so.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see.
The reason I'm interested in Prisma is that basically I'm looking at Redwood.js, which is using Prisma, and that's when I first got exposed to this. And, I think we'll be building the next thing with Prisma.
Yeah, I heard your last podcast with was it Rob from the Redwood team?
Yeah.
Yeah, Redwood does serve as a really nice framework if you're trying to build full stack applications that are backed by an API.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, have you seen Redwood in action at all? I mean, have you played with it?
Yeah, I've had a brief look at it, and it's sort of really nice to see how they're integrating Prisma into it. We're working pretty closely with the Redwood team to make sure that there's, you know, good compatibility, and that a lot of the features that we're working on are sort of in line with the kind of stuff that they're implementing now. One recent example of that is the dynamic providers, which are essentially, I mean, we can get to that later, actually. But there's a lot of collaboration happening between the teams, and it's really nice to see the ecosystem growing.
Yeah, nice one. Yeah, because like if the reason I'm using Firebase is that it just it's kind of low bandwidth for me to have to maintain it. But with Redwood now making a sort of integrated database with React, then it's very tempting to build something that will save me money if I do well with a certain web application, because, you know, running my own database, I can query as much as I like. So
yeah, and these days it's also not that expensive to have a Postgres database running. And a Postgres database can really handle quite heavy loads.
So let's kind of look at this little starter project here. I've cloned it, and it's given me this directory, like this here. I won't hide your face anymore. That's a bad manners, right? So just range these screens. So good. A little bit of live coding here, or live code generation. You know, can't really say I'm live coding. Let me just do a commit here. So it's given me, this is not Redwood, right? Redwood gave me a lot of these files out of the box. When we can compare this to Redwood in a little bit, but since we have an environment file here, which I guess is where the SQLite database lives.
Yep.
And then this thing called schema.
Yes, and you're using WebStorm. I think I was actually looking yesterday. There's a plugin which will give you syntax highlighting for WebStorm. Let me see. If you look for the plugins, look for a Prisma plugin.
Already has a Prisma plugin.
Oh, okay. It already does.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because probably if I go here and command space, not it's okay. Just syntax highlighting, not a generation.
Great. So you have here a schema, and sort of the first things that come up is these model blocks. These are really the core of how you design the data model for your application. And I'm curious to hear, so from your experience working with applications, when you're developing the backend code, what is usually the first thing that you work on?
So back in the day when I was doing a lot of full stack stuff, when I got more experience, basically I wasn't, well, before I learned about migrations and all that kind of stuff, I was doing everything by hand, and eventually my database admin started asking me for like database update statements and things so that it wouldn't be like just click this button and just put this new table here. But I was just using Microsoft SQL Server, and I was just going, if I wanted to add a new column, I'd just go into the database, manually edit it at the time. But a lot of the stuff that you're doing here, you basically, when you create a new table in Microsoft SQL Server, it would give you like auto, a lot of stuff like configured, like you could set things as primary keys by clicking on things like that. So I mean, this immediately for me looks like, you know, a schema that I would have in SQL Server. Optional column, boolean, default values, primary keys, second, foreign keys.
Yeah, so the idea with like the Prisma schema is to try to create a really declarative representation of your database. So typically, I mean, if you're working on an application using relational database, you would have some kind of migrations tool. And the nature of these migration tools is usually that you start off with an initial migration, which creates, say, in the case of a blog, it creates a user table and a post table. And then over time, it's very common, you know, that you want to modify and evolve your schema, add new fields, add new tables potentially. And the way that that's done with a lot of the migration tools out there is that you have to actually write an imperative migration. And that migration can simply be an SQL file, which will have an alter table statement, and perhaps it'll add some fields, or it'll have a create table statement. And that way, say you're working on local development, you created a new migration to add, say, a profile table. Then when you go to production, then you run that migration in production. And then your local database and your production database, they have the same schema. And that's mostly what the migration library is responsible for. The problem with a lot of these approaches is that writing SQL migrations in an imperative way means that you have to define the steps that you want to carry out. So the sort of the delta, the difference between where it was to how you want it to be. And, you know, assuming that you constantly add fields or you add tables, you have a lot of migrations, and then it's very hard for you to know what the actual database schema looks like.
Yeah.
The idea with Prisma is that instead of defining the steps that you need to take, you simply define it in a declarative way as you want it to be. And then Prisma Migrate will actually carry those changes out for you and figure out, okay, what is the current state and what needs to be done in order to get to the new state. And it's something that is very, very easy to show. So for example, you already have this schema and you already have a database, this dev.db file. What you could do is you could actually add a field to the post model. And I don't know, let's think of something for
car.
For a field. Car. Okay, yeah, that's good. Maybe a string. Okay, we added a model car. Oh, wait, so we want to add a car to the post. Is that?
No, we could add it to like the user, I guess.
Yes. So the first question that comes up is, what kind of a relation is that? Do we want each user to be able to have multiple cars?
We just want to have it to have one car.
Okay. So in that case, yeah. Right. And then in the case of... in the case of that relation, I think you can remove the car ID field.
Yep.
And yeah, exactly. So by you defined a car field, which points to which is a car of type car, and then the field will be it references the ID, and then exactly. Now I'll just quickly open up. So we have a really nice page which talks about. So, but the question is, so is this a one-to-one relationship? Can a user have a single car? Or is it one-to-many? But from what I understood, it's one-to-one.
Yeah, one-to-one, yeah.
So one-to-one relationships are quite controversial in relational databases. There's different approaches, but essentially if you want to be able to have one car per user, why don't you just add a car field to the user and not have a relation? I mean, there is the approach where you can relate
that. Let's say two cars then.
Okay, great. That would be a one-to-many. And then in the case of a one-to-many, what you would want to do is, for the user, you want to have a car field. And then instead of a question mark, you turn that into a bracket, the same way that the posts are defined. And then you don't actually need the relation annotation there. But you do need that on the car model. So... exactly. You can remove that whole block there. And then in the car model, we want to be able to reference the user that it belongs to. So for that, it's usually common to add a user ID field. And then that is what they call the relation scalar. And then that is simply an integer. That is the type of this field. Um, Exactly. And then, so yeah, we can leave that. And then we also have, so the user ID is just an integer. It doesn't have the relation. So you can cut the relation and keep that in your clipboard.
Say that again.
So the best example is to actually look at how the post and the user does it. So we have a model called user and a model called post, and a single user can have multiple posts. So on the post, we have the author field.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the author ID. And these are the two fields that are needed for this kind of one-to-many relationship. And you will see in a second why we need those two fields. But the sort of high-level idea is, one, the author ID, in this case, represents the actual field that will contain the reference, the foreign key to the user table. And then the author is actually what we call just a relation field. And that is how you will access the relation from the client. So, for example, if you're pulling up posts, you might want to also fetch the authors of those posts. And the way that you would do that is using this author field, which isn't actually represented in the database.
Yeah.
So then for the car, we would need a user ID essentially field, which would be just an integer, and then a user field or an owner field, which will be the relation field through which we access it through the client. Yep, and then
shame it. Format doesn't work on this WebStorm.
You can actually call the format command from the CLI. Let's see. Yeah, so there is a Prisma format command which you can call, and it will just do that for you. So if you're using, you don't even need to go into Prisma. It'll figure that out. But do you use NPM or Yarn?
Yeah.
Okay, you might have Prisma. Okay, so in that case, you can just use NPX to call the Prisma binary from the node modules.
NPX, okay.
So NPX is like a shorthand command that just allows you to call any binaries that are installed in node modules.
Format?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and that was it. With VS Code, I mean, the VS Code extension is a bit more advanced at this point. So really, you get a lot of help when you're writing schemas in VS Code. But I can imagine that a lot of that will come because the plugin for the Prisma plugin for WebStorm is open source, and there's been a lot of work on it recently.
Yeah. Okay, so database up or something like that, or was it?
Okay, so now it might be actually good to delete the database, the dev.db there, just so we can show the full workflow, assuming that we didn't even have a database.
Yeah.
So at this point, you created your project, and then you created this schema, and you're like, okay, this is what I want my data to look like. We have users. We have each user can have many posts, and each user can also have many cars.
Yeah.
And okay, now we're ready to generate the client. But before we do that, we want to create the database. And for that, we'll use the tool called Prisma Migrate, which essentially you access through NPX Prisma Migrate. Now, it's worth pointing out that Prisma Migrate is still experimental. And that is to say that there's a lot of work being done on it right now, but it's still sort of not production ready the way that Prisma Client is. But NPX Prisma Migrate, so dash dash experimental, that will be so that you can access the... And then the first thing that you do is you save a migration. So the subcommand is save. Without the dash dash. Yeah. Let's give that a go. Okay. Great. So. You can give. All right. Great. So now we have the migration saved. And then the next thing would be to call migrate up to actually apply the migration.
So let me just, for the benefit of everybody watching this, I'm just going to make the dark scheme because my eyes are starting to get sore. Because I was outside today in the park coding with all feeding all the birds and stuff. Because anyone who watches my YouTube channel knows that I like feeding the birds. All right, so let's just check to see what anything's changed on the... So, but I've done that manually, and then they've got this... whoa, 544 files. Okay, we don't have a getignore right. Okay, you might want to add getignore to the...
To the example, is that?
To the generate thing, yeah. Bit better. Okay, so we have devdb, we have migrate lock. Okay, a readme file.
Yeah, so for every migration that you create, you'll see it creates three files. It creates a copy of the schema,
right,
as it was for that migration, and then the steps are the actual steps that the migration will carry out. And the README is just like an information file where you can get an overview of that.
Oh, nice. There's migration that's been generated by Nikos Kachkanis. You can check out the state of the schema after the migration. That's nice. You can send that to your DB admin and say, here's one I wrote earlier, and he'll be very happy.
Yeah, so... These are the kind of things when you have multiple people working on a project, these things really come in handy, you know, because you have everyone wanting to implement different features, sort of like reconciling all of these kind of database changes can be a real challenge.
This is like your DSL that you have internally for Prisma here.
So to say, I mean, really, this is just a JSON file representing the changes that it will make. But this is really an implementation detail that you wouldn't necessarily interact with so much, but it's obviously useful. And I mean, the idea in the future when you're really doing like serious production migrations, you want to be able to make sure that your data is safe and that you're not losing any data by carrying out a migration. And a really common example of that is if you decide to say rename a name field and break that into two fields. So these are the kind of situations where tooling for migrations comes in really handy.
So if you were to split that column into two columns, there would be some way to, the data would be split up as well?
Yeah, so right now that's functionality that isn't implemented yet. But there's a lot of work to be done on figuring out what is sort of the base interface that we can give for doing these kind of things. And there's a lot of outreach with the community to see, okay, like we're getting a lot of feedback about the kind of scenarios and what the interface that we want to provide to that will be.
Mm-hmm. That's ambitious.
Yeah.
Because there's only so much a project can do before it becomes, you know, unmaintainable, or like if it just gets so complicated that it's very hard to stay flexible and agile, and there's always a risk that you could end up falling behind because you're having to support all these new features, you know.
Yeah. And that's where, you know, things like, I think things like conventions and just using good practices and established practices comes in handy. But even that, you know, can make projects difficult to maintain over time.
Yeah. Cool. So what's next?
Okay. So now we've created this migration. Let's run it. Let's open up the terminal again. So we called the Prisma migrate save, and now we're ready. And it tells you run Prisma migrate up in order to apply the migration.
So what was experimental here again?
So experimental is, as I said, Prisma migrate is not production ready. So that's why we put it behind an experimental flag to make sure that people are aware, like users are aware.
Because when I was using Redwood, they were using migrations as well.
Yeah.
But I wasn't typing any of this experimental stuff. I guess they're wrapping a lot of the...
Yeah, they are. I think they're trying to provide a really nice user experience. So when we do that, we can expect the actual database schema to be created. And okay, done with migration. And then let's see. So you can actually open up the, if you want to actually look at the database, you can go to, if you have the SQLite CLI, you can actually open up, if you ls the Prisma folder, you will see dev.db.
Yep.
And in order to open it, let's see, leave the command is just sqlite3, and then you provide it the file.
Okay, I've got a prompt here.
Okay, and then let's see. And then you can, the easiest way I think is to show the tables with that is... Let's see. I think you can do it with dot full schema. I'm not sure if that works. Yeah. Dot full schema.
How to do that? Sorry, sure.
So first of all, it's continuing the command. So we'll do a semicolon first. Yeah, and then we'll probably end enter. Okay, great. And then you can type dot full schema. And then enter, and then you will actually see that the table has been created. So you have all of these, this user, the car, and the posts table. But that's a bit ugly, right?
Yeah.
So why don't we get out of SQLite, and then we show something a bit nicer.
Okay.
So Prisma ships with another tool. So, I mean, Prisma is really like there's three core tools that it comes with. We talked a bit about Prisma Schema, which is used by all three tools, but the three tools are Prisma Client. This is the client that you would import into your application. And there's Prisma Migrate, which we just used in order to carry out the migration. And then there's also Prisma Studio, which is like a UI for your database. So from the terminal, what you can do is you can go npx Prisma Studio. Okay, we've committed the changes. Dash dash experimental.
Is it this? What
Prisma? No, it's one, it's under the Prisma command.
Oh, okay.
And then dash dash experimental. And then if you click enter.
I tried to install something with Brew in some SQLite viewer, but it basically crashed Brew, and then I thought, I'm getting out of this. Because that wasn't obviously. I don't know what it was. Just Brew and just not working. This is horrible. All this stuff here.
Which client were you trying to install?
Brew. Let me just see. DB browser for SQLite or something.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, the good news is, so this Prisma Studio, it doesn't matter if you're using Postgres, MySQL, or SQLite. You can think of it as like an admin UI for your database. Error in Prisma client. So the Prisma client hasn't been generated, which is why it's not working. So why don't we first generate the client and then we'll be able to load Prisma Studio.
Okay.
So we can do that. It's just, let's give it ready. Oh no, it's fine. Okay, great. So there are no rows, but if you click on this button on the left, you will see the very, very left, exactly that one. You will see that these three models. And we can actually use this UI in order to start creating data. So we can start maybe with a user a car.
It's like MPX and I have a browser for the data.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Kia.
Good Korean reliable car. So this is actually, exactly. That's why I was suggesting we first create a user and then we can attach all sorts of data to it. Maybe try to, if you go to the bottom, try to dismiss or refresh the change. Yeah.
I'm good at breaking things.
It's the best way to learn.
Unrecognized model.
All right. Let's discard the changes that we started making.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
Okay. And then we start off by creating a record.
So we're in the user here.
Yeah, and then we can start filling out the email, the name.
Is this validated somehow?
No, this isn't validated.
Oh, okay, then let's write this. Car.
I mean, it's validated against the database types, essentially, but the database doesn't have an email type, so...
Right, okay. Save changes?
Yeah. And okay, we've got a user. Now we can go into the cars and actually start adding cars associated with that user.
That's nice.
And there you go. And it already filled the user ID and you can give it maybe a type.
So car is anything, right? So.
Yeah, this is really up to you to decide, and then you save the changes. And it also saves the second one, which is empty, which is okay. I mean, you can delete it or you can...
Oh, sweet. That's slick.
Yeah. Now, here's the really nice thing. If you go on the top left, you have this sort of... Yeah, right next to that, you have that. And if you go into code mode, what you will see is you will actually see the Prisma client command that you can use inside your application. So this is another, essentially all Prisma Studio does is it uses the Prisma client in order to make calls to the database. So what you're seeing there in the tree view is just another way to view data, and it's nice because you can sort of open up and explore the relations.
How deep does this go, inception wise?
Let's find out.
How much time does my audience have? Okay, it's getting boring now.
But, you know, coming from a lot of the database clients out there, I think this is like a really slick way to explore data, especially when it comes to relational data, because oftentimes, you know, you have to do a query, you have to write some kind of query, and then you have to do the join.
Yeah, that's nice.
And that can be quite, you know, time consuming, especially if you just want to quickly look up data. So this is where something like this comes in really handy. And, you know, you can also filter here. And
So, cool. So what next?
Okay, so we've looked at migrating. We've created a database. We've explored some of the data. We've inserted some data. Let's look at the actual code to interact with the database. And for that, we can open up the script TypeScript file. And so inside the main function, we can start there, and we can actually start by using inside the actual function definition.
Oh yeah.
Where you will write your queries. Then let's think of something that we want to do. Maybe fetch some data.
Okay.
So to fetch data, say from the user table, we'd start with Prisma.
Okay.
Dot. And then this is where it really becomes nice. So because what happens behind the scenes is that Prisma actually generates
no way, man.
A client. That client is tailored to your database
this
schema.
Is legit.
So if you go .car dot, I don't know, say dot find, or you know what, let's create a car first. So, okay, you have all of the functions. And in order to create a car, we'll use the create.
My computer's struggling, man. Yeah.
And then we'll open up an object. And there you go. Oh, you saw that. You had three fields. Maybe we can talk about the three fields. So data, that will be the actual object that will contain the data that we want to create. So here we can
nice.
See we get the owner. And then the owner, remember, is a relation. So in order to, you know what, let's start, before we start with the owner, let's start with the type of the car, because that's just a simple string field. And then we'll do the owner part.
So this is like a node or a front-end script we're writing here?
This is a node script.
Right, okay.
This is, yeah. So what did we have? Yeah, exactly. Type. And then here you can just pass a string. Now, okay, that's a nice car. And then now we're ready to connect that car to an existing user, or do we want to create a new user as part of this query?
Yeah, existing user.
Okay, cool. So first of all, we'll start by inside the object. So it's inside the, yeah, exactly, inside the data object. The name of the field is owner. And then for owner, we'll pass it an object. And then you have two options. Essentially, you can create an owner or you can connect an existing one. And then connect will actually, you can pass it again another object.
As a property or a function?
Yeah, as a property.
You mean like this?
Yeah.
All right.
And then an object. You open up an object.
It sounds like countdown. Have a consonant. Can I have a vowel? My granddad loves countdown.
What's the shortcut with WebStorm for autocomplete?
It's to like open space, up this command space.
Oh, it's the same as it. Oh, there you go. So then you see how you can connect now via the email address that you use or the ID, and that's completely up to you.
Dear. Better was with, right, so okay, you want me to create another
so let's just assign it to your email. That way, you know, we don't even need to look up the ID. And then that will be a string.
It has to be the same as what I have in the database.
Yeah.
Look at that. You can just copy it straight like that. I wish I had prettier in here.
Wish you had, say again?
Prettier.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And And then we're pretty much good to run this query. What I would suggest that we do is, the first thing is we go to the terminal.
Yeah.
And either open up a new terminal or you can close up the studio for now. Okay, great. So we have a new terminal. And then the first thing we want to do is we want to call Prisma generate. So, yeah, and simply generate, and we don't even need experimental. So generate will generate the client, and that is, you know, it's was released for general availability about a month ago, and, you know, this has been really tested a lot. So now we click that, and what it will do is it'll actually look at the schema, and based on the schema that we defined, it'll generate this client. And at this point, I think we're ready to run the application. And we can do that because it's a TypeScript file. There's two ways to run a TypeScript file. You can either use first transpile it, or you can just use ts-node. So it's without the C, it's just a ts-node. And it might not be installed locally, so it's best to just call it with npx as it's defined in the package JSON. And then the name of the file, which is, I think, script.ts. Okay, that ran. We didn't log anything. Now let's open up the studio again and see what we have there.
The studio?
Yeah. So if everything went well, what we expected to see now when we reload is we expect to see another car. And that car should be linked to this user.
Did that code actually run that function main?
Yeah, it should have. We didn't log anything, but why don't we try reloading it here? And then we'll see. Okay, and then, all right, so, okay, well, if you click reload. Okay, cool, so we don't see it. Let's go back to the code and see what we did wrong there. So the main thing I think that is the reason is we didn't use a wait. So all of the calls to Prisma client, they return a promise, so let's call a wait, and then we can actually, let's do a console log and log car after we create it.
Okay.
Yep.
I was looking like, where's the JavaScript file coming out?
Oh, and there we go. We got an ID, we got the type, and we got the user ID.
Oh,
and there we have it.
So this runs locally. So I guess there's a lot of production steps and things like that. That there could be possibly another video or another. Just me going to Google and researching how to do that.
How to do what exactly?
Well, this is local, but then I guess it's deploying it to later on. You deploy it to wherever you're hosting these Node applications and.
Yeah, so we have a couple of deployment guides. We just launched the Heroku deployment guide, which I highly recommend. One of the nice things with Heroku is that they offer also a free Postgres database. So if you're just getting started with an application, it's a really nice way. And also the deploying to Heroku is very, very easy to get started. But there's one more thing that I thought is worth pointing out in this example that we did, and that is the fact that it's type safe. So if we go back just to the code, why don't you try creating, doing exactly the same, but instead of Ferrari, passing an integer. By passing in an integer, essentially, we're creating an artificial type error, and whoop, what do we have there? Yeah, if you hover over it.
Yeah, it won't compile.
Yeah, and that is really, that type is derived from the Prisma schema. This seems obvious, but I don't think there's any database access libraries that provide this kind of type safety without having to write the types yourself, like manually.
Yeah, yeah. Powerful. So I'm just, so this is, I want to kind of contrast this a little bit to what Redwood does.
Yeah, let's do that.
I wonder what that noise was. That's a massive seagull taking a sandwich from my window. The beak is pretty. So Redwood is, so that's Node, but Redwood is generating stuff that's front end tying into GraphQL and all this kind of stuff. So, but
yeah, we can talk a little bit about that. But I mean, the idea with Redwood is you have a backend and you have a frontend. The backend serves a GraphQL API.
Mm-hmm.
And then for every request that comes into the GraphQL API, what it will do is it'll actually make some call to Prisma in order to make changes or to pull data from the database. So you can think of it as like, okay, so you have Prisma that provides you access to the database. That only happens on the back end. And then in order for the data to be accessible to the front end, it has to go through GraphQL.
So in a sense, what you've shown me is about maybe 50% of what Redwood is doing, but then Redwood is exposing these node functionalities via GraphQL on the client. Is that what it's doing? Something like that?
Yeah, that's one aspect of it. And then there's the other aspect, which is all of the front-end related things and a lot of the conventions which make it easy to interact from the front-end with the GraphQL API and to also keep your front-end code nicely organized, you know, where they have the idea of views and they have the idea of pages. And that's a lot of like conventions that have emerged, you know, over the many years of experience that the Redwood team has under their belt.
So say I'm a startup right now.
Yep.
And I want to build a front end application with Prisma database. Why would I choose Redwood versus Prisma by itself?
That's a great question. So the first question that comes to mind is, how do you want to build your front end? Because Prisma has no opinions on that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've seen that you use, I don't know how to pronounce it. Svelte, right?
I called it Svelte for a few months.
Okay. Yeah. That reminds me when Skype came around, my parents used to call it Skypey.
Skypey.
But
that's a good name for a dog. Yeah. Hey, Skypey. Sit, Skypey. Paul.
Yeah. So, say you wanted to use Svelte in the front end. Essentially, if you were building a front end with Svelte, you need to somehow pull the data from your back end, and you might want to build a GraphQL API that uses Prisma under the hood. That's one choice that you can make. Or you might want to actually implement just a really lean REST API. You know, it really depends what you're trying to do and how important it is for you to have a GraphQL API. Mm-hmm. You can also use something like Next.js. And then the great thing with Next.js is that it has the ability to do server-side rendering. So with Next.js, you can actually have an application that just literally makes calls to the Prisma client and then hydrates your components with data from the database. And then you don't need any API layer because essentially every call, the data is fetched from the database and then it sort of renders it back to the client. And then so far we mentioned we have the GraphQL option. You could build your own REST API with Prisma. You could use something like Next.js, which has server-side rendering. And then the fourth option would be something like Blitz.js. So Blitz.js is somewhat similar to Redwood in the sense that it's an application framework for building applications that doesn't require you to write an API. And the core idea behind it is using this idea of RPC, of remote procedural calls. Yeah, so I mean, I was talking about basically the four different paths that are now possible to build, you know, an application with Prisma. And the first one was Redwood. And the idea is it's a full stack framework, and the main interaction between the front end and the back end is through a GraphQL API. And then the second option is using Next.js, which allows you to do server-side rendering. And I can share an example of that after the call where you can see how that sort of happens.
Sure.
But the great thing with that is you also don't have to, you don't have to implement a full API. The disadvantage is obviously that every page is rendered on the server side, which means that you sort of like do away with some of the optimizations that single page applications would have. But Next.js has a lot of flexibility and you can do a lot of different things, but that's just one option.
Yeah.
Then there's the option of using just a simple REST API, building a REST API in Node.js with Express or Happy or any framework that you choose. And then from the client, making calls to this REST API that you built. And then the fourth option is using something like Blitz.js, which is another framework built on top of Prisma. And it also is heavily inspired by Rails, the same way that Redwood is. But it takes a very different approach to compared to Redwood. And the main difference there is that you don't actually have an API layer. It essentially allows you to import server-side code into your React components. Wow. So if you wanted to, say, have a page where you show the cars or all of the users in their cars, what you would do is you would define some kind of a backend, some backend code which fetches that using Prisma, and then you can simply call that in your front-end application, and it handles all of this connecting between the front-end and the back-end, which is, I think, one of the most contentious points in full-stack development, you know, especially, you know, when you have multiple clients, or say, multiple teams working on a project, and, you know, different front-ends, and everyone is consuming from the same API.
So this is a competitor to Redwood.
You could say it's a competitor, but really, I think it just takes a different approach. I think Blitz is a really good fit if you want to build a single client. I think there's a lot of, for example, I don't know if you've noticed this, but I think there's a lot of hype around GraphQL, especially amongst newcomers to development. And while I think there's a lot of that hype is granted, it really depends on your use case. But I think in many cases, if you're building a single front end for your application, GraphQL is not always the best choice because, I mean, first of all, GraphQL is never quite as simple as it seems to be.
Definitely not. I mean, for senior developers who's not used it before, it's pretty tricky.
Yeah. And implementing it, you know, there's so many different options. It's the whole ecosystem is really, it's really in the process of maturing. And so for many applications, especially if there's only a single front-end client, it doesn't always make sense to build a GraphQL API, especially if you just want to pull some data from your database and do some simple interaction with the database. And I think Blitz.js fits into that category very well.
So is this, somebody said here that Redwood needs an API server with client-side data fetching. Blitz totally eliminates all that, letting you build modern React apps where all the data writes are server-side, but at the same time you get the full SPA experience. What?
Yeah. Yeah, we had we recently hosted an online conference called Prisma Day, and we had the author of Blitz.js and also Tom Preston Werner, the author of Redwood.js. They both gave a talk, and I mean, I think both are great frameworks. It really depends on what you're trying to do. And also in many cases, you know, if you're familiar with something like Next.js, there's a lot of, the overhead for starting to use Next.js with Prisma is very low. I think like looking at what we've done today, we've already covered, I would say, a good 50, 60% of, you know, what is out there. And a lot of the rest can be learned by just exploring the API. You have this auto completion in when you're using Prisma, and there's a lot of extensive documentation. So it's really, I mean, for me, like just using this auto-generated client as in, from the perspective of a developer, is something that is really refreshing to see.
Mm-hmm. So you use the auto-generated client, you're meaning Node stuff here.
Pardon?
When you say auto-generated client, you mean the Node code or the...
Yes, I mean the Node code.
Yeah, code. That interacts with it. Right. So like in the Redwood example, the actual Prisma stuff is like just one folder within this API thing. And then everything else, it seems like they've built this functionality with the Node tools and then GraphQL.
Yeah, that's because, I mean, essentially you have to implement this whole GraphQL layer, which accepts HTTP requests, parses the GraphQL query, figures out what kind of a query it is, and then find the correct resolver. And there's a lot of overhead to that. So, I mean, they've really, I think they figured out a really nice way to organize a lot of that with services and so on.
But it's a lot of code to maintain and could be brittle at some point. And
yeah, I mean, the hope is that sticking to conventions can help with that, but it is, as you said, it's more code, and it's really up to, you know, to you to decide, okay, do I really need GraphQL, and do I want to go down this route?
Because like so, in here, there's like, you have to know a lot, but to maintain this stuff, you have to know about GraphQL, and you have to know about, you have to trust that the Redwood code is going to do all the stuff well, as well, you know, as well. That's, comparing it to what I'm doing with like MetaCV, okay, I'm depending on Firebase, but the functionality I'm using, this is all client-side logic based on rules that's in the Firebase backend, and it's really easy to maintain. I have to think a lot about it. I've got some cloud functions that are doing some basic on triggers of users, you know, sending emails, that kind of stuff. But
can you share a bit more about how you fetch data in your Svelte app from Firebase?
Yeah, so there's some stuff that is called the admin commands, which you don't have access to on the front end, so you have to have a cloud function for that. So that's just a case of creating a REST express REST endpoint and then calling the Firebase admin. But that's the same API as the local one, except that you're bypassing all the security rules. But and just in terms of all the data access that I'm doing is just in this file here. So for example, I've got a command called search, and this basically we create a reference to Firebase database, and then we have the path here, and then we're just doing some ordering by, and then we're just getting the value out. And
is this running on the front end?
This is front end code, yeah.
I see. I think that speaks for the great sort of experience that Firebase gives you. I mean, with all the reservations about, you know, using a schema-less database,
yeah.
I think being able to just fetch your data in your front end is a really powerful idea.
Yeah, basically, I implemented search from application in one day. I basically wrote this function, right? I Googled around to find out what exactly I had to do to get this. I duplicated the data, then I looked around for like libraries for drop-down widgets, and then I found some Svelte library that had like 2,000 lines of code. I thought, forget that. And I basically wrote 13 lines of code, and basically that did most of what I needed to do for a drop-down. So basically I have this thing called search string, search result, user closed, and these are variables. And then when the user hits on key up, we do a search, and then the search result renders the div that has the data here. So basically, if search result, if there's a search string, and if the user hasn't pressed user closed, we show this div that's absolutely positioned next to the search box, and then we have a bunch of anchors which get routed back to the user profile. One day, you know, no back end logic or nothing. And I mean, it's not really, I guess there's, it can't be that simple, right? But it can search up to, I don't know, maybe 100,000 users. You know, that's all you need for a search. Like, look at LinkedIn search, you're searching usernames done, or Discord, it's basically just searching display names.
So, yeah, that's pretty nifty. I think the closest you could get to that is with something like Blitz.js, where it's essentially you define the logic for how you want the kind of query you want to do with the database, equivalent to whatever you do with Firebase there. And then essentially you just call that from your front end and, you know, you render the results. And I mean, the only motivation to do something like that with Prisma, or one of the motivations, one of the core motivations, is how important is type safety and having a rigid schema is to you.
Yeah, I mean, for me, rigid schema is important if I don't have things like foreign key or imprint, like things like that. But with like Firebase rules, you can sort of enforce a lot of like stuff in a database that means that if something goes wrong, you'll get a database error pretty quick saying you shouldn't do that. I mean, this is the first application I've built with Firebase, so time will tell. The next one I build, I'll probably use Redwood or Riot. I'm not using Next.js.
If I may ask, why?
Why what?
Why not?
Why not what?
I thought you would use Riot or...
I'd probably use Riot or Redwood, and because I just think Firebase could get quite expensive pretty quick.
Mm.
And I'm kind of locked into... I don't want to build all my stuff with Google Firebase and then be stuck.
Yeah.
And I want to also learn how to use these other tools as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I think like databases like Postgres have been around for quite a long time and they're here to stay.
So what's the business model with Prisma?
Oh, great question. So right now, the main idea is we don't have a commercial product, so we're not really generating any revenue.
Right.
But the idea is over the long term to build some commercial services around Prisma that would be paid services that are, you know, perhaps targeting bigger corporations and so on that might be interested in using Prisma. Mm-hmm. But all of the tools that we looked at, they're open source, and you know, they will continue to stay open source.
Good. Well, I think that's enough for today. That was really interesting.
Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Had a great time like seeing how you approach it and doing a bit of coding together.
Yeah, I like this new format of the video podcast. It's fun, man. So what's next for you then?
Well, we are also working on creating a lot of content inside the developer relations team at Prisma. Trying to create a lot more content to showcase integrations with frameworks and, you know, do the job of explaining what it does and what value it brings. And that's mostly developer relations. And besides that, we've recently made our roadmap public. And as part of the roadmap, we'll be targeting a bunch of things. One of them is expanding the querying capabilities of Prisma clients, so being able to do... We recently released the ability to do aggregate functions, so calling sum, average, these functions. And besides extending the client functionality and the querying capabilities, will be targeting new communities. And there's sort of like two ends to that. The first is being able to create, so we have an experimental Go client for Prisma, which you can use in the Go language. And then also targeting more databases. So there's some good work being done on the Microsoft SQL server, being able to use MS SQL as a data source. And the main thing is also Prisma Migrate, which is in full force right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you get 12. You get 12 million quid here. See, $12 million.
Yeah, that was a Series A. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, just looking at the last couple of months, seeing the funding that a lot of companies in the sort of cloud and developer tooling got. And I think there's, I mean, 2020 is quite a significant year in many ways. There's a lot happening. And I think one of the key things that we're seeing is, you know, how technology facilitates a world that is changing so rapidly. And I think that's, you know, that speaks for a lot of these investment rounds that we're seeing.
Cool. Okay, Daniel, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for taking the time to look at Prisma and for this conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Ruth. Okay, everybody, that was Daniel Norman from Prisma Developer Relations. That was another episode of Learn With Us video format. So until next time, see you all.